Hey gang, welcome to another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio. Today I have with me Mark Dankoff. Mark, welcome back to the show.
Well, it's good to be on. I was on David Duke's show earlier, as you were, Dr. Slattery. We talked about all kinds of things, and this is going to be round two, so it's good to go from Rents to RBN. That covers the full range of all of the top radio people that are out there, it seems to me, in our movement. So this is good stuff.
It's good stuff. We had a good show, and we talked about we talked about the never-Trump takeover of the Trump administration. Well, centered around Jared Kushner, but represented also by the likes of, you know, neocons John Bolton, Mike Pompeo. Maybe he's not exactly never Trump, but still he's a neocon and will destroy the presidency. And now Elliot Abrams. And then we moved on to the their support for this coup in Venezuela with, I'm sure you noticed, excuse me. I'm sure you noticed John Bolton talking to reporters, just happening to hold a notepad with the words 5,000 troops to Colombia scribbled on it for everybody to see. And then finally moving on to the immigration issue. Where would you like to start today?
Well, maybe we ought to start briefly with Venezuela and what this Elliot Abrams appointment means, and some of what we covered briefly on the Duke Show in regard to how this even bizarrely plays into the neocon narrative on Iran and Hezbollah.
Okay. I'm going to throw out this as a way of getting into it. Elliot Abrams is coming back to the State Department. He says it's nice to be back here after a 30-year absence. He had been in there in the Reagan administration and, of course, had been at the heart of this whole Iran-Contra business where originally Israel had been supplying weapons to Iran, but then in order to get supplying American weapons to Iran, but then in order to avoid the middleman, I guess Ali North had arranged for more direct deals. At any rate, we don't need to rehash all of that, but Elliot Abrams gets to come back to the State Department after 30 years. We were speaking earlier on, you know, our wish list for at least a Trump kitchen cabinet, and you know, we admit that the likes of a Mark Dankoff or a Patrick Slattery or David Duke or even a Kevin McDonald, we really, as much as we believe these people would be qualified, they're not accepted into polite company. Why the heck is Elliot Abrams and John Bolton accepted in polite company?
Well, yes, this begs the question as to what's going on here. And this gets back again into something that I briefly referenced on the Duke Show as it pertains to National Bugle Radio, and that is the extent to which the President of the United States has picked all the wrong people in regard to who's running the show or isn't running the show, as the case may be. This is particularly true in foreign policy, and I made reference to the fact that you and I had been decrying for some time the fact that from the get-go, right after the president was elected, he should have been sitting down with a select group of people, the Pat Buchanans of the world, the Phil Giraldis, the Stephen F. Cohens, the Ron and Rand Pauls, have Tulsi Gabbard in there.
And Tulsi Gabbard, he did meet with her, though.
Yes, he did meet with her. Yeah. But I think there should have been a much deeper role for her along with these other people. Throw in Ted Galen Carpenter from the Cato Institute and Doug Bandow from the Cato Institute and some of these types of people to basically steer the president in the right direction in terms of cabinet and sub-cabinet posts and people that could have advised him on what he doesn't have now, and that is quality people in his administration, particularly in the foreign policy area. And it just continues to worsen, this Elliot Abrams thing, naming him as the U.S. special envoy to Venezuela is not only a horrific choice, but it's a horrific choice that is absolutely known to the world based upon this guy's completely outlandish and even criminal background. Common Dreams came out with something on, I believe, the 29th of January that has since been published at Lou Rockwell. and it's entitled Trump's Axis of Evil, Pompeo, Bolton, and Abrams. I would really like for people, we've put it up on the big board at National Bugle Radio, for people to take a look at this, because it underscores some of the basic talking points that I would use in any conversation.
Yeah, so go to nationalbugle.com and you'll see it.
Yeah, go to nationalbugle.com and you'll see it, and it'll take you straight to Lou Rockwell then, where we are reminded by comdreams.org that Abrams, of course, is known around the world as the Assistant Secretary of Dirty Wars. And as it lists some of this guy's so-called achievements in the Reagan and Bush administrations, we're told that in 1993, after a UN Truth Commission, which examined 22,000 atrocities that occurred during the 12-year civil war in El Salvador, attributed 85% of the abuses to the Reagan-assisted right-wing military and its death allies, Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights Abrams said, quote, "The administration's record on El Salvador is one of fabulous achievement," quote unquote. And of course, we're reminded that Abrams organized the illegal covert financing of Contra rebels in Nicaragua behind the back of Congress, which had cut off funding. We are told that Abrams lied to Congress twice about his role with the Contras. He pleaded guilty to both counts in 1991, but was pardoned by George H.W. Bush. Then, a decade later, while working as special Middle East advisor to former President George W. Bush, was an enthusiastic advocate of the disastrous Iraq invasion. Then we're told that he was in the Bush White House, Abrams was, at the time of the abortive coup in 2002 against Hugo Chavez.
Okay. Then, so that's his qualification for this new spot.
Yeah, and then we'll top it off with this one. Abrams helped lead the U.S. effort to stage a coup to overturn the results of the 2006 Palestinian elections, complete with murder and torture.
Okay,
so,
and those,
this is
those,
this guy's
and that's,
no record.
And that's where Gaza and the West Bank were permanently split apart. They were permanently split by his support of overthrowing the parliamentary victory by Hamas.
Right, exactly. And so when you start looking at Mr. Abrams' record, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out what this guy is all about, why he has been named to this particular appointment. And ominously so, of course, we begin to discover that John Bolton and Mike Pompeo are publicly tweeting Elliot Abrams' praises in the last day or two since his appointment. And really, when you look at this in conjunction with what Russia Insider is telling us, they've published a new one just less than 24 hours ago by Dan Cohen and Max Blumenthal, and it's entitled Venezuela's coup leader is a product of the U.S. color revolution machinery decades in the making. That's up on our big board at nationalbugle.com. That's Dan Cohen and Max Blumenthal. And then, of course, when we start looking at what I mentioned on the Duke Show on Rents, and that is that this talk now, this outlandish talk in mainstream Jewish media circles about the evil machinations of Iran and Hezbollah in Venezuela, and of course you can throw in Putin for good measure, right? This belies the real issue that is going on with Hezbollah and with Iran, and that is the warning of the leader of Hezbollah, Nasrallah, in a video that was published with English subtitles at Press Television Iran, a warning to Netanyahu. It's a two-minute video. It basically outlines that basically Hezbollah is ready for what it feels is coming, and it will more than respond. It assures Mr. Netanyahu once Israel attacks them. And then, of course, as I mentioned on the Duke Show, it is not lost on anyone that Press Television also had a major story about the fellow who is the Iranian Majlis, or Parliament's liaison for international affairs, to elements in his own government as well as to foreign dignitaries, had a major conversation that was made public with the Iranian ambassador to Tehran, where the Iranians and the Russians are clearly getting their ducks in a row in regard to what they undoubtedly sense and know is coming. And those conversations take place not only in the context of the time frame of this video warning of the leader of Hezbollah to Netanyahu, then the Iranians had just finished conducting arguably their most extensive conventional military exercises in their history, at least since the Iranian Islamic Revolution of 1979, and that is something called Velayat Power 2019, where they made it a point to say that these exercises are clearly designed to take the initiative once they're invaded. These came complete with film footage and still photographs of the military exercises, where they were demonstrating their ability to inflict massive explosions on an invading foreign power or powers using conventional armor and conventional infantry. So when you look at this whole scenario, it's quite interesting that Elliot Abrams comes aboard as our so-called special envoy to Venezuela. You know, Bolton and Pompeo are singing his praises as the three of them now constitute Trump's axis of evil. And now you have a situation where with Mr. Abrams' public track record of interference in Iraq and in Palestine and in Gaza and in Venezuela and in Nicaragua, he's just the perfect guy that we need representing the United States down there in this present crisis. And this takes place at a time, conveniently, in major Jewish media outlets. Dr. Duke cited one today on the air on Rents. We are now hearing about all of these secret plans of Hezbollah and Iran, and then throw in Russia for good measure, that involve Venezuela. Mm-hmm. So it's obvious what's happening here, and it's a very sickening thing that this is happening in a Trump administration. And again, it gets back to all of the bad people that he has chosen. Yeah. That are guaranteed to steer him in all the wrong directions.
And so we've got this situation where Donald Trump had, during his campaign, said he wanted better relations with Russia, that he wanted to withdraw from these overseas wars. What the heck are we, you know, why are we risking World War III in Syria? Why would we fight World War III over Syria? Saying a lot of things, and maybe the wall was the centerpiece of his campaign, but his foreign policy was clear. Why are we even in NATO? Things like that. And he was elected. Now we're seeing an administration in terms of its foreign policy that I won't say it might as well be George W. Bush, because George W. Bush did embark on new wars. But while Trump, as a person, you know, he's trying to withdraw from Syria. He's announced a withdrawal from Syria. He's announced a big drawdown from Afghanistan. But is it really even going to happen? He's got a foreign policy team that is very much recycled George W. Bush, which is bizarre. So there's been at least this kind of partial hijacking of his foreign policy by neocons. And I'm going to ask a question, but it's almost a rhetorical question because I have a position on it. But the question is, how much of this hijacking has been enabled because Donald Trump himself is so bogged down in the whole, you know, Russia collusion business and the Mueller probe and all of this? And one last thing I want to throw in there is I hear sometimes, you know, progressives, people like, there's a guy named Jimmy Dore. I think he was with the Young Turks. You have people maybe associated with the Green Party who are going to, you know, they're going to be out there slamming Donald Trump for having appointed, whether it's Nikki Haley or John Bolton or Elliot Abrams. But this is what I say to them. They were, these people from, you know, the Young Turk crowd, the Greens, the progressives, were anti-Trump from the get-go. It didn't matter that he wanted to withdraw from the war. It's just that because he was going to be mean to illegal aliens, he's going to be mean to the Dreamers, he is an evil man, and so they totally disregarded all of the things he was saying about foreign policy that they supposedly agree with. And so it really rings hollow to me to hear them gripe about what's going on, to hear them gripe about neocons being in charge of foreign policy. The reason neocons are in charge of foreign policy is because they're smarter than the progressives. The neocons didn't like Donald Trump, but they offered themselves to him and got in. The progressives refused to cooperate. They opposed. They were never Trump. They were the resistance, and they have nothing to complain about, because the fact that we've got neocons running the State Department and foreign policy is because the progressives, who supposedly shared these principles of better relations with Russia, peace, withdrawing from the Middle East, they rejected Trump and resisted him from day one. That's what I think. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that that's true. The other thing about these so-called progressives that is absolutely amazing to me is that where are these people when it comes to noting the fact that in terms of the so-called NATO Support Act, which recently passed the U.S. House of Representatives, not only reaffirming U.S. involvement in NATO, but reaffirming that there will be no attempt to spend any federal money to get out of NATO and so forth and so on, that this received a 357-22 vote margin. There wasn't a single Democrat mm-hmm. who voted mm-hmm. against this NATO Support Act. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that when we come to all of these appropriations, supplement appropriations and otherwise that involve Israel, there are very few peeps heard in the so-called progressive community on that.
Yeah, and no peeps. Did you hear anybody talk about that in the progressive press, that vote?
Absolutely nothing. There may have been somebody, but I certainly missed it. And then last but not least, of course, when Kamala Harris announced earlier in the week that she was going to run for president, that's our African-American U.S. Senator.
I thought she was an Australian Aborigine.
Yeah, and she in fact, is a very, very a clear supporter of the American Israel Public Affairs Committee.
She's married to a Jew.
And Netanyahu is tweeting her praises. The last time she showed up off the record at the IPAC conference, just to have a private chat with him. So when you start looking at this kind of thing, this gets right into what Phil Giraldi has been underscoring at the Council for the National Interest and the articles that he's written in the UNS Review and other people like Phil Giraldi. And that is that the progressive, so-called progressive left in foreign policy is looking increasingly like the neocon Republican right, and that in effect this is something being missed by so many of their grassroots supporters. The anti-war movement in the United States, which could be such a powerful, legitimate mainstream movement in the United States, encompassing all of some very significantly good people from left to right, has not yet coalesced, mm-hmm. And that, it seems to me, is both because the progressive left will not work with people like Pat Buchanan and Paul Craig Roberts, and even when he happens to do something correct, Donald Trump, and yet these are the same folks who seem not to notice that some of their chief standard bearers are going along with the basic agenda of the war party, especially mm-hmm. as it pertains to the Israeli line on Iran and Hezbollah and the need for regime change in Iran and, of course, the demonization of Vladimir Putin.
That's right. We got to go to break, but,
sure.
they were able to mobilize a million people for the Pussy Hat March, so we know where their priorities are.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Okay, so we'll be right back. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the show. So we started off talking about Venezuela and, of course, Elliot Abrams' path back to the State Department is his appointment as a special envoy for Venezuela or some sort of special post for Venezuela.
Yeah, he apparently is the U.S. special envoy for Venezuela. I think that is actually, as near as I can tell, his official appointment title, his official job title.
Okay. Now, Venezuela has been much vilified in many circles for a while. It certainly has been much vilified in more like mainstream conservative circles. Do you think should we really be going in? What about all of these refugees who might leave Venezuela? Wouldn't they come across our border? Shouldn't we do something about it?
Well,
I mean, you can tell from my tone of voice, I'm being kind of sarcastic, but that's the those are the talking points, it seems.
You can almost see those talking points coming. And it seems to me that in terms of the catastrophe with refugees in Europe and refugees specifically, especially from places like Iraq, Syria, and Libya, that as far as all of those are concerned, those have largely been caused by the very war policies that the war party and the Zionists advocate. It seems to me when it comes to Venezuela, or for that matter, anywhere else on the globe, Middle East, Latin America, wherever, the United States would be best served by letting indigenous peoples of a particular country decide for themselves who they want as the leader of their country, what kind of a political system they want, and let them make the kinds of choices that hopefully will facilitate a view of the United States as a benevolent outsider, which is anything but the view that they have of us now for some very, very good reasons. When you start talking about this whole business of regime change, it's once again with people who are making arguments like invading Venezuela to stop a further flow of refugees headed toward the United States, that this is the kind of thing that always masks the real agenda, which is stealing someone else's natural resources and engaging in actions like the Bank of England withholding Venezuela's gold from them when they've requested it back. Mm. Certainly the announcement.
What right do they have to do that?
That's right. Absolutely none, right? And then, of course, you've got a situation where the United States is announcing sanctions against the Venezuelan regime that will only hurt the poorest people.
And we'll call it the Venezuelan government, if
yes.
you don't mind.
Yeah. And then, of course, last but least, we then appoint a so-called special envoy who has a history of being involved in nefarious, illegal attempts at, and in some cases, successful acquisitions of regime change in ways that flout international law and that flout common sense and flout the long-term interests of the respective countries involved. So when you start looking at this from that vantage point, it seems to me, in conjunction with the problems of the United States, with an overextension of military commitments in the Middle East alone, and with a burgeoning trillion-dollar-a-year budget deficit situation, and with the flames of war being fanned by a variety of Zionist and neocon elements who are suggesting that we need to attack Iran as the next step in their program of disaster in the Middle East, you can well imagine what an American military commitment would mean in Venezuela, not simply in terms of risking lives, in terms of dollar expenditures, but think of the blowback, not only in Venezuela, but throughout Latin America, if you had an overt American military involvement in Venezuela, given our entire history of interventionism down
there. That's right. Well, here's something. You know, sometimes on Tucker's show, he gets these people to argue the pro-immigration stance, and, you know, a foil for him to debate against. And one of the people, I don't know what his name is, but he's based in San Francisco, and he looks and sounds like he was probably the understudy to Cheech Marin of Cheech and Chong movies. And well, seriously, I mean, that's what he looks and sounds like. And probably smells like. He probably has a lot of that rank odor of marijuana on him. But at any rate, one of the points he makes is that these people from Nicaragua or El Salvador, you know, if Tucker makes the point that one-third of the people of El Salvadorians on the globe live in the United States, he says, well, United States back in the 1980s was funding, you know, Contras or funding death squads or this or that. And so American intervention in Central America, according to the logic of an awful lot of people, is justification for the mass migration of their population into our population. Now, Venezuela, look on a globe, look in the almanac. Venezuela is much, much larger than Central America, all the Central American countries put together.
It's larger geographically than the state of Texas, to put it into perspective.
It's much larger. Well, yeah, I mean, it's substantially larger. Do we really want to be giving justification for another 35 years of mass immigration by having this kind of intervention? We'll talk about that when we're back. We'll be right back. We are back. It's National Bugle Radio with Patrick Slattery and Mark Dankoff. So, Mark, Venezuela, their government might be mismanaging the economy, right? They might be mismanaging the economy. So shouldn't we save them from themselves?
Well, it seems to me that if we were going to talk about mismanaging the economy and mismanaging foreign policy, that we ought to have 10 different countries invading us. It seems to me that one
is that an invitation?
we could ask Putin and the Chinese and the Iranians to invade us because we're having domestic problems and we could use some outside help.
I think I would choose the Russians out of that list of three.
Yeah, I would too. I would choose the Russians if I was going to be invaded by a foreign power,
Still, even the other two, the runners-up, I think I prefer them to our current Zionist overlords. In fact, I know. I prefer them. Yeah.
Yes. So, but at any rate, when you this whole situation, let us ask ourselves, in the long run, what the United States achieved with Operation Ajax in Iran in 1953. You can read something about that in my old markdankoff.com website. My discussion of Kermit Roosevelt and Operation Ajax, that's still there in that very dated website. What did we achieve when we disposed of the regime in Guatemala, I believe, in 1954 at the behest of the United Fruit Company? What have we achieved with all of these other coups d'etats and assassinations that we have undertaken around the world?
Support of various rebel groups like the Mujahideen in Afghanistan.
Yeah, right.
That turned out real well, didn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. So that obviously came back on us later when our erstwhile against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan later became our adversaries. Speaking of Al-Qaeda and Mr. bin Laden, and then, of course, subsequently all of the other difficulties that were created by the American intervention in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Libya, this terrible criminal activity that we have been involved in supporting these Sunni Wahhabic extremists in Syria, the genocidal war that Saudi Arabia is conducting against Yemen with the full support of the United States, and the logistical support, I might add, of the United States Air Force, sadly enough. So then when we turn again to Latin America and we start looking at the history of American interventions in the Caribbean and in Latin America, just in the last 100 years of history, there is a perception of us that is anything but positive, not only in Venezuela, but elsewhere in the region. And while on the one hand, we are told that when you start head counting in Latin America, I saw a map a day or two ago, which showed that in the Latin American continent, I'm trying to remember, the Venezuelans have just a couple of countries that have come out in support of them. I'm trying to remember.
I would think it would be Bolivia and
Ecuador.
Ecuador,
possibly the other. Most of the others, at least, are speaking publicly that they line up with the United States. But that's for now. If the U.S. were to invade that country militarily, subsequent to having Elliot Abrams as our special envoy to Venezuela, it might suddenly start dawning on at least a few leaderships of other Latin American countries that this is a very old movie that is replaying itself with a very bad ending, and that what is being pointed today at Maduro might be pointed at them tomorrow. It will also not be lost on the political masses in Latin America, who in many cases don't like the particular regimes that rule them, that if their regime is supporting so-called Yankee imperialism in Venezuela, that maybe they ought to have a new government in their own country. So all kinds of Pandora's boxes are traditionally opened by these kinds of interventions, covert activities, coup d'etats, assassinations, economic sanctions, military threats, overt military invasions. Take your pick as to what combination of these may be in the Elliot Abrams toolbox for Venezuela. But nonetheless, the end is not in doubt in terms of the fact that there will be, in the longer run, incredible disasters coming out of this, including a circumstance where if Hezbollah and the Iranians and the Russians and the Chinese and so forth and so on haven't had too much influence in Latin America up to now, one can say that the kinds of things that Elliot Abrams and Pompeo and Bolton have planned for Venezuela suggests that the climate could well be created by the increase by their actions in an increase in the activities of all the people in terms of international players that they claim to oppose. Mm-hmm. The same thing has happened in the Middle East, mm-hmm. where arguably Putin's hand has been strengthened, certainly by what we have done in Syria. The Iranian hand has been strengthened, it seems to me, in Syria, when the Americans badly played their hand with the Israelis and the Saudis in supporting these Sunni Wahhabic murderers against Assad. But then, of course, when you look at the American conventional invasion of Iraq in 2003, can it be lost on anyone that the ultimate outcome of that was the eventual establishment of a central government in Baghdad that was pro-Iranian and Shia? There are all kinds of things that these guys never tell us about when they start talking about how wonderful it will be to have a regime change in the interest of democracy. But the fallout from these operations, be it in the Middle East or Latin America, has a very, very long history of tragedy. We don't need any more of that. And I also think the average person is smart enough to know then when it starts coming down to a major central bank, in this case the Bank of England, withholding Venezuela's gold when they've asked for it back, when it comes down to having billions of dollars in economic sanctions against a country like that being enacted by Bolton and company, this is going to cause a major resentment toward the United States, not simply in Latin America, but those countries in the Middle East, for example, and the Russians, some of the stuff they've been subjected to in the last year because of all of this hysteria. Right. It's not going to be lost in their peoples and their governments either, there needs to be a greater political unification of all the peoples and countries of the world that have had about enough of this Anglo-American Zionist banking empire.
Right. So regarding Venezuela, here's my basic position. Venezuela over the past 20 years, they've been dominated by the politics of Hugo Chavez, the late Hugo Chavez. And, there are things to be said about Chavez's politics, both on the pro and con side, his politics, his economics. He was utilizing the oil wealth of Venezuela for foreign policy purposes and whatnot, neglecting reinvesting in that oil sector. There's all sorts of things you could say, but first of all, their election system seems to be pretty fair. They have the machines that print out paper ballots, so there's a paper trail. Their elections are contested. Chavez never won all of his elections. He lost National Assembly elections. He lost a referendum. And then after he died, the election to pick his successor was extremely close. Maduro just won by about a percentage point and a half or so. And of the most recent national election, the National Assembly elections, the ruling party lost by a large margin. So they seem to be fair, first of all. And so they can vote their way out of this. Some people might say, okay, well, what has democracy done for Venezuela? Well, maybe some people might say there's a tyranny of the poor non-whites over the more economically productive whites. And maybe that's been the case, but when people are starving, it's probably going to be the poor non-whites who are starving. And if that's the case, they'll vote for people who are going to function better rather than just simply look like them. That's another thing to be said. So they can vote themselves out of this. But here's the other thing. Let's just say they have a coup. Good. That's their business. It's not our business. I don't care who they elect. They can elect whom they want. If they have a coup, if the military takes over or whatever, that's their business. And the third thing I'd say is, if Brazil or some other countries get involved, again, that's I still don't want to be intervening. And I don't think Brazil's really going to want to intervene and have this be a proxy war in Venezuela against Russia and China. I doubt it. But if they're going to do that, still, I just don't think we should be involved at all. Last thing I want to say, and I don't know if you noticed this. I was watching the PBS NewsHour, I think it was yesterday, and Brazil had some flooding or something, some sort of natural disaster this week. And guess who's come to help sort it out? I think they said 3,000 Israeli troops, which are now in Brazil for some sort of disaster release. Had you noticed that? I think that was just reported yesterday.
I had not seen that story. That is a fascinating development and potentially has a lot of spin-off derivative implications, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the thing is, one other thing about American intervention is American intervention, I think, it's pretty much always on the wrong side. I mean, isn't American intervention almost always against our national interest? Perhaps it's because the people who are in control of our foreign policy don't really have our national interest at heart in the first place. They have a very, very different value system and set of priorities.
Yeah, and if one understands it that way, which I certainly do, then a lot of these models make sense. Who runs the foreign policy of the United States? We might argue who owns the electoral process in the United States.
Well, who finances it? We know who finances it.
We know who finances it. We know something about the ownership of the six major media consortiums in this country that formulated largely out of the media merger movements of the 1990s when Bill Clinton was president. We know something about central banking, don't we, and fiat money, and who it is that up to now has controlled the post-World War II Bretton Woods financial system that grew out of the Second World War, and that presumably is the basis for the New World Order, which desires to bring everyone into that banking system by coercion and force who isn't already in it. That's a major part of this whole business as well. And then, of course, with Venezuela, this also involves oil resources. Who has the largest oil reserves in the world? Has anyone asked that question? And when we ask that question, that may have something to do with the particular interest of Mr. Bolton and Mr. Pompeo, and certainly their beloved special envoy for Venezuela, Mr. Abrams, in regard to bringing democracy to that country, right? Democracy in quotes.
Well, just they like have democracy a lot more than we do. Whether that's good or bad is another issue, but right, they have a better electoral system than we do.
Yeah, the issue with democracy with these guys like Pompeo and Bolton, Abrams clearly is making sure that somebody that their constituency controls is in power. Democracy, for example, is Elliot Abrams being involved in an attempted coup against Chavez down there in 2002. Democracy is overthrowing the results of a legitimate election in 2006 in Palestine, Gaza. Abrams was directly involved in that and bringing somebody in who basically was the beneficiary of what you could argue was an American coup. Democracy is doing what the United States and the EU and Israel and Jewish banking interests did in February of 2014 in the Ukraine, right? You overthrow Yanukovych, mm-hmm. Whatever his pluses and minuses, he was legitimately elected in that country. His election was recognized internationally as having been legitimate. However, he gets overthrown when he decides to undertake an investment and banking deal with Putin instead of the EU, because Putin apparently offered the Ukraine a better deal. So that means Yanukovych has to go, and all of a sudden the latest version of democracy is Poroshenko, and the United States and the banking interests, the Zionist banking interests that are represented by what the U.S. and Britain and the EU are always doing in these situations, has now taken to interfering with events going on in the Orthodox Church in Ukraine, and apparently providing some financial incentive for this Orthodox Patriarch in Constantinople to create out of thin air an authorization for the Ukrainian Orthodox Church to break away from its historic overseer, which is the Russian Orthodox Church, and obviously the implications of that should be obvious to everyone. Nonetheless, this is the extent to which we play this democracy game. We have all kinds of covert means available to us to coerce, to intervene, to subvert, to manipulate, and if all of that fails, of course, then using a downright military invasion and occupation becomes the last weapon of choice. But the question is begged, how much longer can the United States go with this kind of methodology before experiences what Paul Craig Roberts quite clearly understands it will experience, and what all corrupt empires, declining empires experience, and that is that they ultimately run out of manpower, shall we say, people power, if you want to be politically mm-hmm. correct today. Mm-hmm. They run out of people power and money to sustain these kinds of global operations. Ask the ancient Roman Empire, just as one example. Ask the British Empire of the 19th and 20th centuries as yet another example. The neocons and Zionists and international bankers running the United States government have not apparently yet figured out that there's no way that any of this is sustainable, or that they can't continue to sell these kinds of policies over the long haul to a domestic, albeit comatose, up to now American public. And certainly they can't sell these policies to indigenous peoples in these different countries who have figured out by now exactly what's going on. It reminds me of a photograph I saw on Facebook before I left that venue, and it shows this American Army soldier dressed up in all of this regalia, you know, the high-tech helmet. Mm-hmm. And he's got his AR-15 and all these other things. He's in his camouflage gear, and he's saying to this little boy, dark-skinned boy, he says, "Don't worry, son, you'll have a central bank here very soon." And this stuff is going around Facebook, folks. I think everybody pretty now.
Okay, I have a question.
Yeah.
So we have about a minute before the next break, but what do you think that the United States is actually going to get involved militarily in Venezuela, or is it just going to be more posturing like we've been doing for so long vis-a-vis Iran? And actually answer that after the break. Okay, we're right back. I had miscalculated the time. So, are we getting involved? What do you actually think is going to happen?
Well, I think in Venezuela, we're obviously involved with the economic sanctions, with the political manipulation. Our chosen fair-haired boy, Guaido, or whatever his name is, has been the product of at least 10 years of neocon interventionist grooming in the United States, according to what Russia insiders reporting with Dan Cohen and Max Blumenthal today. I don't think we'll be involved there militarily, except maybe with a token force around the American embassy after there's a riot there in Caracas. But on this Iran thing, it seems to me that this Iran talk is very serious. And the only thing that is left to be determined is how many Zionists in the American national security regime actually believe that Iran and potentially Russia will be the so-called cakewalk that Kenneth Edelman forecast for Iraq. I think most Zionists want to invade Iran and to engage in overt regime change with military force. But on the other hand, what percentage of the American military has it figured out that the American military might well go out of there with a AWS whipping? Whoever wins that argument will determine whether or not we go into Iran militarily or not.
You know, I think it's really hard to predict what's going on. I think the situation's in a great deal of flux, and something maybe as simple as Ruth Bader Ginsburg leaving the Supreme Court could be a massive game changer. If Trump felt he could trust the Supreme Court to uphold his exercise of his own presidential authority. You know, and he could build his wall. He could, and I say his wall, it would be our wall. He could fire Mueller or things like that and not be impeached over it. Who knows what would happen? Maybe that's just wishful thinking.
We're going to find out. Who knows? We shall find out.
Okay. Oh, we've got about a minute left. I just want to point out that nationalbugle.com is really worth looking at. And Mark Dankoff has been putting up lots of great stories there. So you want to check it out. Don't be going to Drudge. Don't go to what else is there, Breitbart News. Look at these stories. They're from a variety of sources. They're from some mainstream sources. They're from some not so mainstream sources, but places that you would want to know about. And, you know, Mark is great at finding these stories. I put up some myself as well. So it's a good source to go to and see what's going on, things that you might have missed. Okay, Mark. Well, thank you for being on the show again.
And enjoyed it always. Probably see you tomorrow.
I look forward to that.
Very good. See you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow. We'll be back again with another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio.